Welcome back to another episode of Out of the Blank Podcast. Joe, it's a pleasure to have you back on the show. Would you like to introduce yourself to everyone out there listening, or do you just you've been on like seven times, I think.
Yeah, pleasure to be back. Yeah, I'm a guy what writes stuff.
Good stuff. Very good stuff. Wide ranging too, like from Jonestown to JFK. You touch all the topics that I've started to notice, and this is kind of why I wanted to have you back on, because I feel like you give a really good breakdown of, but when we talk about the idea of conspiracy, when we talk about the idea of history, what would you paint the picture of for people who are trying to understand history might not be this perfect textbook version that we always read?
Well, I think a lot of the problems, trying to word this correctly,
It's a big
a lot of the
question.
problems, huh?
It's a big question.
It is. And a lot of the problems that we're having now is precisely because more people are becoming aware that history is not necessarily what they told you about in school, or that the people who run things are not necessarily the public facing people who run things. And as a result of which, at this time, there's currently a kind of pincers movement that is going on to try and get people to stop saying things they don't like on all of these various social media channels and television and everything else, which was a lot easier to control before the internet, when everybody just accepted what Walter Cronkite told you. And so they've had to come up with this idea that people who are quote unquote into conspiracy theories are, violent extremists or are somehow dangerous, which is preposterous, really. Believing something different from the state doesn't inherently make you inclined to violence, because frankly, there's nothing more violent than the state itself. And this has been true throughout history. And that is the great lesson to learn. In general, if you just study history for thousands of years, the entity that is creating most of the violence is always the state, not the individuals. So that's maybe a good way to start. Does that help you?
It does, but I'm curious why historians could be so disconnected, even though in some cases they could look at something that could be probably more the realistic version than maybe what the fantasy version is, that might be a societal, have societal undertones to it, or some type of capture of society's mind. But there's a lot of things of history, like the Tuskegee experiments and things, that get mentioned all the time that people know are really horrendous acts, but then they stop there, like these were just isolated incidents, and don't try and bring them onto things like the heart attack gun, or the CIA on college campuses, or wiretapping individuals, or breaking into Black Panther Party organizations to stir up violence. Those are all real. But it seems like there's a give and take on even academics' perspective of it, where I'm like, why would you ever say no to it if you haven't bothered looking into the information?
Because so there's two things. One is that it's not all historians do buy into that. And in fact, within a certain boundary, there's a lot of dispute. So there are historians who believe one thing or another, but it's all within this kind of box. Okay. So the kinds of things that we're talking about are something that no professional historian will advocate for because they are a professional historian. So, which is to say, they're part of the institution. And once you become part of the institution, you have to protect your flank because your job, your family depends on it. So, you're not going to say anything blatantly against the state if you're working in that field. You've got to, if you're interested in sneaking it in, you have to try and sneak it in, which some historians have done. I mean, one thing that I point to for people to understand how this works is to look at the career of Michael Parenti. Michael Parenti is a tremendous historian, but he's also a Marxist, and he's not quiet about it. He also writes about the Kennedy assassination, as a result of which he's had a very nomadic career. Michael Parenti has worked for all kinds of different places because he makes it institutionally difficult for any place that he actually works for. So he is a professional historian. And writes brilliant books, but he's worked at all kinds of different universities, wandering around because he says things that the state doesn't like all the time, including pressure points, including with, the third rail of American politics, right? The Kennedy assassination. He's not afraid to write about it. And that's, you will find that to be true. So that although there are historians who will argue in general about different things, a professional institutional historian is not going to attack the institution that he's a part of. And that also goes for other areas, science, everything. So if you are part of this thing, you are not going to come to the conclusion that your thing is a negative effect in this world. You mentioned the Tuskegee experiment. I point people to that all the time, because the important thing about the Tuskegee experiment, besides the fact that it was a horrific attack on a class of people that they did not regard as people, which is, say, African-Americans, Black people, it went on for decades, more than 40 years. So that means that you had these scientists that started the project. They worked on it, and then new scientists came on board, right, over the course of 40 years, you know, two generations, essentially, and nobody said boo. Even when these gentlemen had syphilis, and when a treatment for syphilis was developed, they deliberately withheld it from these men to keep up their experiment. And the horrible thing about syphilis, of course, is that when you have it, you transmit it to your wife, you transmitted it to your kids. It's a horrendous disease. So that's an important thing to remember when you're looking at these kind of institutional factors. The Tuskegee experiment was allowed to go on for up until the 70s, which is just insane. And that should give you a hint as to what else is going on.
Let's try and avoid that type of discussion, because I know that will get flagged off YouTube. I just started hearing you say it. I was like, I know it's 100% fact, but dude, I already told you about videos I've gotten. They've changed their guidelines on harmful conspiracies. But I'm like, then when can you not talk about certain things? You're not going to be able to anything.
And that's what they're pushing. So, I mean, this whole idea that somebody is not allowed to say something that is 100% fact and still get kicked off of YouTube or whatever, that should tell you something else about institutional power, institutional authority.
Well, yeah. It's like, why wouldn't you try and look into something to sort out if it's fact or fiction? I'm finding less people are likely to look into something like, again, the CIA heart attack gun, or just even MK Ultra. Like, I would never use that as an example of an outrageous thing for the government. People go, well, that's the worst thing. It's like, yeah, but it's so unknown to so many people, even though there's a large amount of people that are aware of it or have heard the name. There's just so much where I'm like, does anybody ever do any deep dives anymore? Like, you've done Jonestown, you've done JFK stuff, episodes of mine. You've done so much research into a lot of political areas where you can kind of look at, like, the worst extremist examples are not just isolated incidents. They keep going.
Exactly. And you find the same people turning up over and over again. That's wholly because of John Judge. Because when I first met John Judge, he started talking about, he didn't even talk about JFK per se. We were discussing how institutional power works in this country. And that's what led me to all this other stuff, you know. So, and what you find is that if you look into the Reagan assassination attempt, you know, everything, the October surprise, like, you learn all of this stuff that is generally not reported on, except it is, but it's in paragraph 22 of some story, and the news never continues it. They continue to always pull focus. And that's the art of what is considered journalism these days. You pull focus all the time. Don't look at this. Look at this thing. Oh, look at this thing. Look at this big, you know, the big thing. This crazy guy took a shot at Reagan. Don't look at his family. That's not relevant. Don't look at the fact that his brother was going to have dinner with George Bush's brother the night after the shooting. Pay attention to none of that, because none of that is relevant. The relevant thing is, here's a crazy guy who tried to shoot somebody. And that's the story, period, slam dunk. And now, I mean, because I guess more people have become aware of this stuff because of the internet, the movement to shut down all this discussion has gotten fiercer. And in Canada, they're looking at, like, possible criminal proceedings, and they're writing a lot of crazy laws out there. And I assume that that's coming, that that what they would like to do is they sort of look at China and drool and say, this is the kind of control that we would like to have. We would like it to be more like North Korea. Like, supposedly we're for freedom and liberty, but you know, we need to make sure that people are not saying things we don't like.
Well, let's try and find things that can relate to a bigger discussion that we've had before, which is the JFK assassination. Why don't we explain things that could not be interpreted or not be misconstrued as false information, things that are factual based when it comes to covert operations, discussing what covert operations are, discussing types of covert operations, discussing old government projects in the past that we've used to assassinate foreign dictators. You know, these things that are not necessarily, I have academics on, a friend of mine that studies these. It's a field, but we talk about plans like Northwoods. That's the insane of the insane that gets, I think in December of last year, it was getting chalked up to be a conspiracy theory because the document was so outrageous.
Yeah. Yeah. And James Banford wrote about that, 20 years ago, I think is the, in one of his books, I can't remember which one. Yeah. And the thing is that it's a moving target. So whenever you're talking about covert operations, it's very important, covert, right? So these are things that the government cannot admit to most of the time by the very nature of what they are. So when you're studying something like this, you're always sort of scrabbling at, you know, what information can I find? And it's, you're always digging up small documents. Sometimes people go on the record about things, but you're not going to have the kind of evidence that you would have to say, you know, you're never going to be able to prove that some covert operation happened without anybody admitting that it happened. It's not like you have a complete record. It's always an incomplete, crazy record. And we know, for example, like in the Kennedy assassination, that even documents get created for the purpose of misleading people like us who go in and actually look at this stuff. Most of the time what they're counting on is what Alan Dulles said, the American people don't read. So they're just counting on the fact that if we tell them that this is what happened, they're probably not going to go look. And that's mostly true. People do not generally do the work because it's a lot of work and it is a hall of mirrors. You're chasing all this stuff and some of it's contradictory and it's, you know, it's a real big mess. And it requires a lot of intellectual effort to separate this stuff and actually try to figure out what's going on.
Well, it requires time in a fast-paced world.
Yes, a ton of time. And who wants to put all their time into dealing with, you know, this really horrible stuff? I do. Yeah, exactly. I was talking to a filmmaker about possibly doing something with Jonestown. Because there's going to be a number of Jonestown films that are coming out because the 50th anniversary is coming up.
We got some of our clips to trend. That was pretty cool.
Yeah, not a bad thing. But
damn, Diane Feinstein, I can't believe that shit. That's crazy.
But he basically said he was like, do I really want to spend my life on something this like horribly negative? Like, I don't know if I had the mental capacity, the energy to do that, which I totally understand. It is like there's never good news in any of this crap. However, we have to know this. If we're ever going to fix anything that's going on, which I grant you is a long shot, we have to know this. We have to. I was talking to somebody the other day. They were asking me about the Kennedy assassination. And I said, put it real, real simple, right? Mid-50s, the United States aided the overthrow a guy named Mohammad Mossadegh, right? And the guy who wrote those plans was Alan Dulles. And most people think that Alan Dulles is a key player in writing the plans to overthrow the United States government, which I think is basically correct. So, and that makes sense because that's his job. So he just kept doing his job, but he did it domestically where before it was in foreign countries. And you find that to be true with, you know, guys like Bill Harvey, like the, you know, guys that were actually like mechanics in addition to planners. Once you understand that, like once you start learning this stuff, that's when you start to find the connections. And I think that can be a hook for people too. When I was talking about Chappaquiddick, one of the things that like blew my mind is that E. Howard Hunt pops up again. Like, what is E. Howard Hunt doing at Chappaquiddick? He's investigating. He's investigating what happened, and he brought a disguise kit with him. Like, how crazy is this stuff, right? But that's what he said. So he is the guy that that information is coming from. What do you do with that, right? Because Hunt turns up like a bad penny.
Well, how would you take a logical approach to conspiracy theories or thinking when you're looking at subject material? And then also, how would you define logical or plausible sources? Obviously, you mentioned about documents. When you tell someone that, oh, we just don't have the documents for a covert operation, people tend to go, oh, that's just fitting. Like, skeptics will say that. We'll say, oh, that's just fitting. You can't find your proof. And it was like, well, when there's a lot of things that are intelligence secrets, they're not meant to be released. They're not meant to be in the public's information. Then people will be like, well, that's just explaining why you can't show something. It's like, but you don't even look at the stuff I'm able to show. So I don't, there's not a win-win, obviously, but how would you go about looking at logical sources of information and really trying to validate if a claim is true or not? I mean, you'd strike me as a person that doesn't really take anything and go, no, that's not real. You probably would go, okay, let me look into that a little bit, which is a smart, logical approach, but it's not the norm.
Yeah, and that's part of the point. I mean, that's basically what my whole book is, my last book, Tinfoil Hat Not Included, that's basically what it's about, is about demarcation. So this is demarcation, this fancy word that just means sifting through the chaff and trying to find what you're looking for. So the big difference is exactly what you said. So when I'm evaluating a claim, I don't give anybody credence any more than anybody else. So just because somebody is the chief of police doesn't make me more likely to believe what they're saying, or the president, or anything else, because I have too much experience with how institutions function. So if you're making a claim, okay, let's look at what's out there, and let's see if that has any relation to reality whatsoever, because sometimes it doesn't. And the fact that somebody on the street says something and somebody in some high position says something, the person in the high position might be wrong, might be deliberately, and the person on the street might be right. You just can't use that to evaluate claims. You have to go and look, is there a basis to what that person is saying? And especially in this thing, one thing that you'll find is, especially in like a newspaper, somebody will say something and they will make some mistake. You know, they will say, you know, this person did this thing and it happened in Paris. And maybe it didn't happen in Paris. Maybe it's in another city in France or something. And they jump on that and they make it all about that. But every other detail on what the person said is true. So a lot of times you're kind of looking at these things and evaluating them in terms of, is what does the overall picture look like? So I like to look at the details and then I pull up. I go up. Does this appear to be more plausible than this other explanation? And if it is, then fine, let's go with that. Let's look at that. And you're evaluating these claims the same way you would evaluate any other claim. And that's the other big point that I make in that book, is that the scientific method is exactly what you should be using. That is empirical evidence, but it's for everything. It's not just for things that authority tells you is correct. Argument from authority is the worst possible argument. And if you tell me that Michael Shermer said something, at this point, I understand where Michael Shermer is coming from, and I understand what things he might be truthful about, and I understand what things he's going to lie about.
Well, they have straw man points. Like, you know, Occam's razor's straw man argument, when you really talk about the most simplest thing is obviously the answer, and all these ridiculous things that get added on or tacked on, it's just added belief. And I do believe that in some cases. But one of the Shermer arguments is that, you know, people couldn't just get over the fact that it was a president being killed. So there obviously has to be some bigger grand conspiracy with JFK to make it sound like it could be plausible or the public can get away with it. That makes a lot of sense, unless you start looking at the number of people that have lied. Gerald Ford editing a back wound up 6 inches in a report, the brain going missing. There's too much to be like, Oswald wouldn't even had the capability to be able to do half of those things. He wasn't in contact with JFK's autopsy. He wasn't any, none of these sorts, but it sounds really good if you're really looking for a quick Google and you look at someone who is an intellectual. I mean, Rich brought this up, but he was talking about what's your educational background, you know, when you talk about photographic evidence, you talk about this. And I go, but do you trust those? Because I can tell you, I've met a bunch of academics that are not smart at all. They're really good in their one specific area. And that's much like Jordan Peterson. That's much like Michael Shermer. That's much like Dr. Phil. It's much like all these guys. They're really good at what they've researched and looked into, but they're dismissive of everything else. And that's why they're an expert in that field, nowhere else.
See, and I understood that at an early age because of the environment that I grew up in. And that's absolutely true. You know, if someone's an expert on Troy, they can tell you everything about Troy, but they're not necessarily that up on anything else. They're going to read the newspaper just like other people do. Like, so they have no special knowledge. when you're talking about, you know, somebody like Shermer or Noam Chomsky, very similar, you pointed out something exactly right, which is that what they will do is they will kind of hand wave stuff they don't like. So they'll just say, well, yeah, you know, Oswald wanted to be famous and, you know, that's what, okay. What is your evidence that Oswald wanted to be famous? Well, his brother said that his favorite TV show was I Led Three Lives. That's your evidence that he wanted to be famous? Okay. You're going to have to do a deep dive on that to make that remotely plausible, because on the flip side of that is that we know he was a Marine. He was a kid. He was doing all this strange stuff. He was going to the Soviet Union and getting married to the daughter of a general and then bringing her back to the United States with no problem. And all the crazy things that are associated with Oswald that have nothing to do with psychology. So pointing to psychological explanations is what a lot of these guys will do when they don't want to deal with the facts. They do not want to deal with the facts whatsoever. Shermer doesn't, Chomsky even less. Chomsky will just say, well, I read the material, which he did because I know the guy who sent in that material. But he won't specifically say what he read. And he won't point to any points where he says, you know, I disagreed with this point. He just does not engage. He says, oh, that's a bunch of nonsense, which is really weird in Chomsky's case, because he does believe that Martin Luther King was killed in a conspiracy, which is very odd. It's a topic for another day. But the point being is that you're exactly right, is that in any of these individuals, however brilliant their resumes may be or their reputation may be, you have to look at what they say like anybody else. And it's very interesting when you – so the example of it that you gave about Occam's razor, right, that Richard brought up, and he was annoyed because he said it was in my tinfoil book. It's actually in my first Descending Views book. Big deal. No big deal. But I wrote about William of Ockham, who is he was in part something called the Grey Friars since he was a child. Basically, he was a scholar. And the beginning of 14th century. And what William of Ockham said is that you should not needlessly multiply entities, which comes to be the simplest explanation is always to be preferred. Fine. Doesn't really work in biology. You know, biology is a series of like lean-tos and strange pathways for things. If you try to apply Occam's razor to biology, you're going to be wrong every time because of the weirdness of how animals come to be animals, living things come to be living things. But the main issue is that it's just a piece of advice. It's like an Aesop fable. It's like, look before you leap. He who hesitates is lost. That's basically what that is. And one day, a few years ago, somebody sent me this discussion on ResearchGate about Occam's razor. And somebody, I don't know how these guys found this, but they found my article that I had written about, and they started arguing about it. And these guys are all professional scientists, physicists, scholars from all over the world. So some guy from Norway thinks that I'm right. And, you know, some guy from Sweden says that I'm wrong. And this guy in South Africa said,
it's always the Swedes.
Well, it was just fascinating to see. Like, I assume none of them knew that I'm a quote unquote conspiracy theorist. They just took the material and they started dealing with it the way they would deal with anything else. And I found that both like amusing and instructive that they took it seriously and they were talking about it. Because I think it's a serious, I think it's a serious piece of reasoning. I think I'm right. But it was interesting to see that, because in another context that would never happen, had they known its provenance, they probably would not have argued that. But I put a link to it on my website because I thought it was, you know, just cool to see all these people from all over the world arguing about this stuff. But that's exactly right. You have to continually, you're continually having to disregard institutional and this kind of authoritarianism that people gravitate to, because they have a lot to protect. Yeah, money, family, everything. They're invested.
Yeah, but people are able to look up the truth for themselves to be able to prove that intellectual wrong, right? It's not something that's like there's so many things where I'm like, you can't really, like, Posner, all these people, I'm like, guys, mm-hmm. tell me, you've seen this. You can easily Google. Like, I can Google this and the Gerald Ford wound will pop up and that'll pop up. And they just, nope, just like, it's like a complete disregard for that. Or that, how does that relate to there being conspiracy? I was like, I don't know. Why would a future president lie about a wound to make the, in his terms, wound fit the single bullet theory? So it's like, I don't know. He said to make it more clear. That's what he said.
Yeah. Yeah. He said for clarity.
So
yeah.
I was like, why would you not consider that a little bit suspicious? Doesn't mean Gerald Ford was up in the building taking a shot or taking a shot from the null. It just means, like, why would you be trying to fudge evidence and just not report the facts? If you're telling the truth, then there shouldn't be a problem here.
That's the point. That is the point. Especially after Watergate. For someone to be all fired up about conspiracies and say, well, conspiracies are crazy after Watergate is ridiculous. Like, what are you talking about? And in fact, almost everything that happens in modern life is the result of a conspiracy. And I talk about it in my book. And I don't mean like big things. I mean small things. Like, if you work for a financial center, you know, you work for a bank and you're a teller, do you know what the hell's going on at your bank? Like, are you invited to the big meeting where there's 12 people around a table deciding the future of the bank? You know, no. I used to work for USAA, right? I always imagined that I'd go up to somebody and say, hey, you know, I have this crazy conspiracy theory. I think that the board of directors of USAA are doing things without our knowledge and without our participation. Is that a conspiracy theory? No, it's just the way it functions, right? Not everybody is invited to the party. And so the decisions that get made that affect your life, you are not invited to, which, by the way, that's the truth for almost everything, right? We are born into this, whatever society we're born into, and there's a thousand decisions that are made that have nothing to do with us. So as a nature of how bureaucracy operates, of course, there are little compartments making decisions about all these different things, and the most powerful one is at the top. I mean, how is that even controversial? And yet it is. You're a conspiracy theorist if you say things like this.
What are the warm-up examples you would give to people if you were trying to get them to hear you out on some of these things that might be out of their perception but can be logically shown evidence? And it would actually, because if you mention JFK, people aren't going to sit and want to listen to that for 5 minutes. But if you mention something more light touch, and they'll give you that 5 minutes, and then you can open them up to a deeper kind of world. But when I ask this, I also want to ask, what are the most extreme examples that you would never drop on someone for the first time? I would consider the Castro plots an easy one to drop off in the first, because it's more believable because it's not in our country. And it was about a dictator or someone that a lot of people are, and I'm not rationalizing anything Castro did, but a lot of people believe that he was this ruthless dictator that was going to be bent like a Hitler. And so I'm like, I don't know if he was a Hitler, but a lot of people in Cuba didn't like him, but I just felt the government saw an advantage to get one of their own men in.
But actually, he was massively popular. I mean, that's how he was able to take power and hold it for so long.
They gave him free ice cream. You see the pictures on the internet.
Yeah. Yeah. So, I mean, the important thing is to not believe this stuff. But yes, I try to point to things that are in the newspapers all the time. And I think I mentioned this before on your show before, but my favorite one that I like to point out to people is Bush's Secretary of Defense, Colin Powell. Colin Powell was being interviewed one time, and he was at a press conference, somebody asked him, "Do you feel bad about the fact that, you know, the U.S. kidnapped Salvador Allende in 73 and, you know, overthrew the government?" And he said, "Yes." And he apologized. He said, "Yes, yes, we, you know, obviously it's part of our history. And, you know, that's, you know, it's not a good thing that we did." Except the State Department then got very upset because the United States has not officially said that they did that. And so Colin Powell knows the real history, and he got tripped up. He said too much. Now, he knows it so well. I mean, obviously we overthrew Chile, right? He knows it. So he just answered the question without realizing it, that he has this kind of doublethink, that he knows stuff that he's not supposed to say. And he got kind of reprimanded for doing that. And that's one of my favorite examples, because most people are aware. Well, not most people, maybe. Most people who read the newspaper are aware that, you know.
Who the hell reads a newspaper?
Chilean government. There are people. They're mostly older, but, you know. But if you have some interest in American history, a lot of people are aware of that. I also will point people to, like, the Fred Hampton case, because
I pointed at that with the academic, and he was like, "Yeah, I 100% believe that." But I was like, "But then you don't believe the CIA had a heart attack gun?" Which I get. That's a lot. I was very like, that's conspiracy talk. And then I saw the video and was watching. God, I wish I could really remember his name. I think it's Towers. Towers. That's doing this. And he's like going, like, because he's trying not to laugh. And that's like, he's just like weirdly grasping the tip of his nose. But he's trying not to laugh because of how insane it is. And he knows about it, I'm sure. But at the time, he was just like, "I can't believe this is, like, being shown on TV right now. This is insane."
Yeah. And it does sound funny, but all that, like, James Bond, you know, Get Smart. You probably don't know what Get Smart is, but good. Good, funny show. Anyway, but all that stuff, like, a lot of it was real. Like, I mean, it may have been writers coming up with these ideas in the writer's room, but there are things very similar to that, an umbrella Control. That shoots a dart, and, you know.
Control.
Yeah, right, yeah. But, you know, so that's another thing that you bring up people. If you say to somebody there's an umbrella that can shoot a dart, I mean, it does sound like James Bond. It sounds ridiculous or whatever. But a lot of times you can actually find the information about this stuff. A lot of it was destroyed, of course. But naturally, secret agents did have, you know, different little tools and things that they could use, and that were used in assassination, ice bullets and things like that. So, you know, people may have difficulty with it at first, but at least you have big sources that you can point to. Like you say, you can say, look at the Church Committee video. It's 5 minutes and you'll see what I'm talking about. So I do tend to lean on stuff like that. I don't start with JFK because it's such a mess. It's very difficult to start there. The other thing I talk about sometimes is I will talk about the Bobby Kennedy shooting, because fewer people are aware that that happened, and that one's so simple to explain, right? It's physically impossible that Sirhan shot Bobby Kennedy, like, completely impossible. Could not have happened. There's no way, because the bullets are going in the wrong direction, and they're entering into Bobby Kennedy's body at a distance that Sirhan, that everybody agrees Sirhan never got close to.
Plus, it was like 11 or 14 shots, not...
Well, there's all, yeah, and, but you don't even, you know, there's your, I mean, it's like everything else, it blows up, and then you look at the LAPD and they're taking stuff down from the walls, but you don't even have to get into that. It's just, it's like a 5 minute demonstration of, you know, I'm shooting you in the, you know, where am I going to hit you? And they always say, like, in the chest, and, like, no, that's not where Bobby Kennedy was shot. I shot in the head and the back, and there's a bullet that goes through his jacket, but it's all coming from below him and behind. And Sirhan did not get behind and below Bobby Kennedy. and certainly not close enough to shoot him in the back of the head. That's insane. And then you point out that Sirhan's still in jail. He's been in prison since 1968 for a crime that it is physically impossible for him to have committed.
Yeah, people bring up, why should we care about this stuff? And I'm like, because it's still affecting somebody's life out there. There's still people that would like to know answers to certain things and have that curiosity, which is why I don't like hindrance of the discussion about it.
Exactly. It also cuts into people's empathy. I can't tell you how often I've talked to people who say things like, you know, man, that Sheriff Arpaio is great. And he takes prisoners and he, you know, makes them work outside and they stay in little tents and he doesn't give them food and water. And like, how terrific is that? That's exactly what those guys should be doing. Because they never imagine that they would be in the position of the prisoner. But there's no guarantee of that. Like, first of all, that's crazy and inhumane. There's no reason to take people who have committed crimes and then put them under conditions which will turn them into sociopaths. Like, how is that helpful to anybody? Like, you can make a straight societal argument. But the main thing is they will never see themselves in that position. Like, I never commit crimes, so therefore nothing will ever happen to me. Well, sometimes it does. Sometimes it does.
Do you find most people would find out probably more that they're conspiracy theorists, or what the word would be deemed as, rather than just, because I think if people understood, like, everyone probably has like a paranormal experience or something like that. But if you just ask people, like give them a survey of like, what would you say happened in the RFK situation or the JFK situation or this or this or this? If you put a little bubble that says, not sure, but I don't really believe the official version, then technically they're conspiracy theorists because they're not buying the original thing. Now, I know the definition Rich explains, but would you find that if you gave people probably a survey, people would be shocked to find out that they're probably conspiracy minded, only because that their brain can make the logical conclusion that there's just certain things that aren't making sense here?
I mean, absolutely. And the proof of that is, you know, the Kennedy assassination polls. They poll people, and at the time, even people didn't believe it. And it's always consistently hovered around 75% of the American public doesn't buy the story. So, yeah, I think most people do understand that things are hanky. And they do. They may not consider themselves conspiracy theorists as such because that label has become so derogatory. But, yeah, most people understand. I mean, most people are aware they're getting screwed. And I've said this before, but even Trump supporters are not wrong that they're being screwed. They're just not right about it being the fault of immigrants and black people. That's the crazy stuff part. But they absolutely have a sense that, you know, the American dream is being set on fire. You know, they're not wrong about that. So yeah, most people are conspiracy theorists, whether they want to be or like it or not. Any thinking person is presented with a few facts in any of these cases, we'll say, geez. Yeah.
What about when you speak at conferences, not just JFK conferences, but if you were going to, I'm sure people have reached out to you about your book, but when you're trying to talk about conspiracies, like how do you try and reach out to the academics? How do you try and get people to understand, like, hey, let me explain to you, not the examples that you mentioned before, but just give them like a deeper understanding about covert operations, secret intelligence, the way these agencies work, the way it's had what's worked through history, from its creation to its manifestation into something that really affects everyone's reality. I don't believe that the OSS really affected much of what was going on today. I believe this is a lot of CIA and more modern day intelligence activities that have been built upon. But, you know, we've had a lot of things that have occurred that have not really been fully thrown out, but haven't been acknowledged 100%. So I'm curious, when you have people come up to you and ask you about your book, or people that talk to you about conspiracies, what's the reception you get? But then also, how do you talk to people about these in ways that they can try and rationalize an overall theme to want to look into it even more?
So I don't usually reach out to people like that. I have in the past done talks for the public, or we go to a church or something, and I'll talk about some of this stuff. and I'll pick a topic. Martin Luther King is a good one because everybody knows who he is. Most people know, if they don't know precisely COINTELPRO, they're at least aware that the government and the FBI in particular really disliked Martin Luther King. And so if you understand, because everybody's heard of Martin Luther King in school at least, and you can start from a baseline. So that is a place that I will start, and I will talk about, you know, what happened to Dr. King. But what mostly happens is that people call me. Like somebody sees me somewhere, or they read, and I get, or they send me a message, or in some cases, cold call. I mean, people actually used to be more common when I first got into this, is people would just find my phone number online and call me. I think the I think your generation doesn't really like to do that. So I will get messages on email and stuff. And usually they're receptive. A lot of people, though, will ask me about one thing. And then if I bring up something else, they go, wait a minute, what? And they might not like me as much after that, because I'll say things like, they may have very strong feelings about, you know, one particular quote unquote conspiracy, but they don't want to talk about another one. Or this also happens. They call me and they want to explain to me why Lyndon Johnson killed Kennedy. And then they find out that I'm not really on board with that.
Click. And then you're done.
Well, no, I don't do that.
But look, part of the cover up 100%, but no, I've had conversations with the Lyndon Johnson people. I'm sorry, I just can't get there on him orchestrating and creating the whole plot. I definitely think he knew about it.
Yeah, exactly. And that's the other thing. It's like everything is in these hard binaries, even in conspiracy. Like they want, you know, you believe this or you believe that. And I was like, well, the problem is that the more you know, the more you know that there's nuance about everything. But if it turned out that Lyndon Johnson gave the order, then fine. Like, I'm not opposed to that. I just think it's unlikely, because I know how these things happen, and they're institutional in nature, and it would be the professionals who are orchestrating this, not just a guy who happens to be, you know, the vice president. He might be all for it, but he's not the guy who's pushing the buttons. It just doesn't work that way. You know, it's you're always looking at committees and boardrooms and institutions. It's not, you know, Dr. Evil who's orchestrating all this crap. And some people don't want to hear that. They want to hear, you know, this is what happened, blah, blah, blah. You know, and that, by the way, that goes the other way, because there are now people, because the CIA has become so popular, like when I say popular, popularly known, people will point to the CIA all the time as doing this stuff. They'll be like, oh, the CIA killed this guy and the CIA killed this guy. And it's like, well, not exactly. Because again, and this is something that John Judge used to talk about, is that the CIA, their budget is dwarfed by the DIA, for example, Defense Intelligence. And there are also tons and tons of alphabet agencies that are not the CIA. So it's, if you just say that the Central Intelligence Agency killed this person or that person, that's usually not 100% correct either. There is always this coordination of efforts, like what we see in the Kennedy assassination, right? There are different groups that are working together to make this happen. But in the case of Kennedy, I think it's the Pentagon. But it's important to understand that all of these things mix together. And they may be allies, like, for example, the FBI and the CIA may be allies on one thing, but they're not allies on everything, because the FBI has their own agenda that they're trying to do. And this is true for everything, all these little pockets. It's exactly the same, really, as like as countries. You know, sometimes countries are allied on one thing and sometimes they're not allies on other things. The same thing is true of these little bureaucracies that have been created. Same thing. But again, that's more complicated. People don't want to hear that. It's like, oh, that's, you know, sorry. You got to do a bunch of work.
I'm going to change it up a little bit, but I'm going to ask you, what's the definition of the CIA, or what the institution's definition is, compared to what you've learned from about what the CIA actually does? And also, I would say I wouldn't say the public's reception of it, but more about the workings of it. I mean, I hate to put it like that, but obviously there's varying viewpoints on what the Central Intelligence Agency actually does. But I also want to go through the CIA, the FBI, and then hopefully we can get to the NSA, because I couldn't tell you for the life of me what the hell they do, to be 100% honest with you. But I've heard a lot of people, and I've looked at their JFK documents. They don't trust the FBI or the CIA.
Right. Yeah. No, that's true. And again, going back to John Judge, he always used to point to this video of, which is probably still on YouTube. I think it was Senator Inouye, and Senator, I'm pretty sure it was Senator Inouye, who asked a representative from the NSA to see the charter. Now, a charter is the foundational document for an agency to exist, right? Like I've talked about before, Ian Fleming wrote the CIA's charter. So this senator wants to just see the charter of the NSA. And the guy tells him, well, I think that's national security. And he says, okay, well, go ask your superiors or whatever. And they come back and he says the same thing. Like, and in a ways, like he's blown away. He's like, I approve your budget every year and I cannot see your charter. Nope, national security.
It would have been funnier if they would have just laughed. Like, can I see your charter? No, seriously, can I see your charter? You're a funny man. No.
You're not even close to having the security clearance necessary to look at the charter, which is nothing. You know, just this document that says they have a right to exist. So you're absolutely right. The only guy that I'm aware of that's written any substantial books about the National Security Agency is James Manford. And we really don't know. They do, or the National Reconnaissance Organization. We don't know a whole lot about them either. And that's the point, that there are lots of different agencies, and sometimes they coordinate with each other and sometimes they don't. And so if you can't, like, for example, when the government was smuggling heroin during the Vietnam War and Laos and in Vietnam, the CIA had this program called Air America, which is what these pilots were doing, which actually the movie American Gangster kind of touches upon. You can see how scared they were to really get into it. But it touches on the fact that heroin was being smuggled back in the United States in the corpses, in the bodies of American GIs. This most macabre, just horrible thing. But even there, it's not just the CIA. The CIA has to coordinate with the Pentagon. They may have to coordinate with the Air Force. So there's all those things. And the other thing John used to say is, like, the CIA is a think tank. They have to work with other people. It's not like the CIA can use its own tanks. Right. So it's not a bad thing to think of the CIA in terms of intelligence. But if that's your default, you can get led astray, because it's not like we just get rid of this one agency and solve all our problems. That's not what it is. It's that these are coordinated efforts that are used in different, depending on what kind of operation it is. Which, again, you know, I'm always giving the more complex answer that nobody likes. What are you going to do?
FBI.
Well, I mean, the FBI is the basic difference between the FBI and, like, the CIA is that the FBI is not supposed to have any foreign agenda. It's only a domestic agenda. So they only operate in the United States. But the FBI, especially under Hoover, which essentially, while Hoover was in charge of the FBI, the FBI is basically synonymous with Hoover. It's whatever Hoover wanted. And Hoover, the thing that he wanted the most was to protect his job. Hoover liked being the head of FBI. So he got secrets on congressmen, on senators. That's what he did in the early part of his career. And one of his jobs was to interview some of the prostitutes that run around Washington, D.C., mm-hmm. which are clearly visible if you take a walk at night on K Street, which I did. And you will see, like, hookers coming away from these brownstones. Some of them look very young. Like, oh, Jesus. Yeah, what am I looking at here? And because of that, he was solidifying his power. And what Hoover used to do is he'd go up to some senator or something and say, hey, listen, you know, we got these pictures. We found out, you know, you've been shtipping this blonde at a hotel or whatever. And, you know, obviously I don't care about this, but if the Soviets were to, or your enemies were to get a hold of this would be bad. And the senator would get the message. I'm like, okay, so what's your agenda again? You know, so that was a way to consolidate power for himself. And that's another layer of what you're looking at, because although there might be institutional goals, you can't completely rule out the individual goals of a person. So it's a mix. You know, Hoover did not like African Americans, to put it mildly. And so he ended up using a ton of the FBI's resources on stomping out what he considered to be traitors and people who wanted to overthrow the government, which, I mean, the Panthers kind of did. I mean, they didn't want to, they were not advocating that, but they were advocating carving out a peace so that they weren't continually living in poverty and continually moved away, you know, from the rest of the world. And he just was, you know, he was not interested in integration. He was not interested in helping anyone.
Which, if you look at the COINTELPRO files, they mention extremist groups as what the whole COINTELPRO program was. But even with the KKK being listed on there and other things, the one thing I tried to explain to the academic was like, he was like, yeah, they were obviously going after certain left-wing organizations. I was like, well, the KKK is not left-wing. They were going after extremist groups, but a lot of evidence supports that their control and their most supportive aspect in efforts to stop a certain group was groups like the Black Panthers and was a lot of left-wing organizations. Just because right-wing people groups were labeled in the document because they were going after extremists doesn't mean they went after the right wing. You know, they went after the left, I think, is a lot of what history can support as far as we know, document-wise. And I think that's because of individual people that were in charge of those institutions. But can it not go bad when you have that much power? I mean, I don't. It couldn't just be Hoover. It could be anybody. But the fact that so many people were scared of Hoover because they thought he had a blackmail file, that is not, dude, that's just like, I mean, take a deeper insight into history on that one, but good God.
The family jewels. Yeah. No, he did. He did. Absolutely. And the FBI, so they have to police things. So they were looking at, you're right, they were looking at certain extremist groups. But also, thing, and some people get mad when I say this, but it would be like if the Gambino family killed all of the Colombo family, you would say, well, the Gambinos are anti-crime. No, right? They're not anti-crime. They're anti the Colombo family cutting into their own profits. So you have to look at it that way. So it's not just that you are, you have this, like, these organizations have this overriding dependence or allegiance to truth, justice, and the American way. I mean, it is, as they see it. But some of this is just getting rid of the competition.
Oh, no, 100%. I believe, obviously, the FBI is not above any organized crime. I think we can look at that throughout history and show that they've actually probably done worse things than any mob figure, any mob movie we've ever seen get done. But I try and find things where you have to report the correct information. And when I say that is, a lot of times COINTELPRO is explained as terrorizing left-wing organizations. And I say, hang on, if someone looks up COINTELPRO and they see the actual documents and they bother to go that far, they're going to see the KKK listed on there and consider anything that you said now to have holes in it or flaws. The way you have to explain it is, this is what the document states, all extremist groups, but history has shown us that it has been targeted towards individuals like the Black Panther Party. And I've noticed that just from the JFK stuff, if you get a little minor detail wrong, you know, people will jump on you about it. And it's like, okay, well, we can make those conclusions, we can connect those dots, but this is actually a really good question. Why is there so many connections in the JFK stuff that don't make fucking sense? I mean, hate to say it like that, but there's like, why do I need to know that the sister of this person was also on a date with this person the next? No, I don't need to, but that's something you find out because you're digging in. You mentioned an example earlier, I wasn't trying to use that one, but that is a really interesting example about the Reagan shooting, and then afterwards his brother was having dinner with George Bush. But how do you come across, how do you explain all the connections without making it sound like, all right, there starts to be like a fantasy thing to the public's perception?
Yeah.
You know, if they've never heard of it before and you're going off talking about that Oswald's mother used to sleep around with a mob person, or you talk about JFK and Marilyn Monroe and then RFK with Marilyn Monroe, everyone just starts going, man, this really sounds like a good Hollywood movie.
Well, some of that is done on purpose. Some of these breadcrumbs have been left on purpose. And I have always balked at including Marilyn Monroe in this stuff, basically for that reason. I mean, first of all, was there something strange about her death? I mean, sure. But that has nothing to do with the political aspect of it. And that's what my primary interest. I'm not, I mean, somebody can be interested in, presidents who sleep with other women or whatever it is. That's fine, but that's not what I do. Like, that's not relevant to my work unless that has something to do with a specific assassination. And I kind of, it's funny. The comedian Richard Belzer, who has written, well, he's alas passed on, but he wrote three bestsellers in his lifetime about the Kennedy assassination and
Hit
various
list.
things. Yeah, Hit List. Yeah, it's a pretty good book. It's kind of a Penn Jones book. But Belzer would, the things that he would get excited about, and I saw this, in person. Like, we were shooting an interview with Belzer at actually at Dick Russell's house, and Belzer started talking about Marilyn Monroe. And he got so upset that he couldn't continue. And he started walking around the room going, ah, geez. And so he had some connection to, Marilyn Monroe was a big thing in his life. And that's fine. Like, that emotional connection is, that's him. We're not going to use it in the documentary because I don't think it has anything to do with the Kennedys. What does this have to do with anything? This doesn't have, what I want to hear about is, mechanics and planners and reasons for the Kennedy assassination, and none of that has anything to do with Marilyn Monroe. And so I don't like it when that stuff is mixed. I feel the same way about UFOs. The one exception I will say to that, not UFOs in general, but just that UFOs have nothing to do with the Kennedy assassination. Although it turns out that's not entirely true. There's a great book by Ken Thomas called JFK and UFO,
Yeah,
which has a really,
I
it's a
know.
goofy conspiratorial title, right? You look at it and go, what the hell? But then you read the book. And because Ken is not talking about Ken was a fantastic researcher, brilliant, brilliant guy. And he is not talking about, aliens murdered JFK or whatever. It has to do with some really strange connections, like to Guy Bannister, for example. I don't want to get into the whole thing here. But that's also kind of a, if you were teaching a course in the Kennedy assassination, that's like a graduate level course. You wouldn't start out with that, right? That's when you get really involved and you know a lot about the case. And now you read this book and you go, holy crap, look at this stuff. So I dislike the fact that it's grouped together with, Bigfoot and UFO and all, which, and again, I have nothing against Bigfoot. I mean, to me, that I don't know a lot about it, but to me, it's perfectly plausible, that there are additional hominids running around the Washington forest. I mean, that's okay. That's
The episode around your episode release will be a Bigfoot researcher, a buddy of mine, who actually told me that his friend knew Jim Mars and got a lot of Jim Mars's stuff, which was like, holy shit, thank God. Like, I wonder who, I gotta remember what that guy's name is. But no, the interesting connection point is, the basic point is, who killed Kennedy? If you don't believe it was Oswald, who did it? But then that can lead into, okay, then you come across a name like Robert Mayhew. And then coming across that name, you find out he's related to Howard Hughes, and he gets stuck into this, or not related, but he has some relation or friendship with Howard, or Howard Hughes. And next thing you know, you're diving down this eccentric billionaire's life, and you've lost the original point, which was who took out Kennedy if you didn't believe Lee Harvey Oswald. I mean, out of anything, you join these forums on JFK, and you've known because you've been involved in the community for however long, that you start to see that everyone has like these really weird independent niche details that have nothing to do with the basic point. And I don't know how that happens. I mean, maybe it's from researching something for 60 years and you just kind of go off on little branches and you go, how do you stop the rabbit hole is the point. How do you stop
I mean,
diving from the point?
I don't think you stop the rabbit hole by telling people not to pursue rabbit holes.
Do it.
And
Yeah.
I'm really glad you brought that up, actually, because the same thing happens in academia. Like, so professors will, they get hooked on something. They find something and they go, oh, wow. And sometimes it's accidental. They just happen to find something. And then they end up becoming experts in that one thing. Like, it's not that, you know, you are an expert in Russian history. You are an expert in Russian history from 1820 to 1840. Or you're specifically about one person or whatever it is, or one event. Or you're studying American finance and you become an expert in the Federal Reserve. So, you know, you read about what happened in 1913, you go, wow, okay. And you get out. So I actually don't think that's inherently negative. The only problem is when it gets out of those spaces. So if you're on a board, you're on the JFK boards, it should be open season. You should be able to talk about anything even remotely relevant. And then it's your job to show why it is relevant. And people get way into the weeds on that. So, I mean, if you've ever tried to follow one of the medical discussions, you will have guys talking about all kinds of very specific information, which I think is absolutely fine. It's fine. It's not what I would lead to for the general public. Like, I wouldn't say that you should go look at this discussion, you know, about this very, you know, with the brain, you know, fragment of bone. That may or may not have come out of Kennedy's head and how large it was and whether it fits in it. Like, I think that's fine for scholars and researchers. I don't mind the rabbit holes per se. Even like the one you just pointed out, that's not a bad rabbit hole, by the way, because there's so many different processes that you're trying to study with this stuff, getting onto Robert Mayhew means that you have found a center of energy that may or may not have that, well, that possibly has specific ties to the Kennedy sessions, but also has ties to Watergate and to other players. You know, then you find like Robert Bennett and you start, and you're like, okay. And you're learning structurally how the American government works. I always go back to this thing that Mae Russell said. And then she told John this like 50 years ago. She said that American newspapers had gotten so bad that the only thing worth reading were the society pages, because you could see who was marrying who and who was connected with whom. And that told you more than anything on the front page would ever tell you, which is, you know, that makes sense. I don't think these rabbit holes are necessarily bad.
When did the newspapers take a decline?
I mean, I would point to Watergate, because the American public became so cynical after that happened.
Pentagon, I mean, papers.
For good reasons. Yeah. And it became more important to report the news in a way that people did not, that didn't happen again. And even the journalists who, I don't want to get into a big discussion about this, but even the journalists who were interested in taking that story apart felt kind of sick about it and didn't want to do it again, which I also understand too. Like, there are things that I've studied that make me a little bit sick and go, ah, geez. And there are things that I don't write about for that reason. You know, I will write about lots and lots of stuff, but there are things where I go, you know what? I don't even want to deal with this right now. I got too many other things going on. I tend to think that it was probably the late 70s when things started to go bad, which I think is part of the reason that Carl Bernstein wrote that piece about the Rolling Stone, in the Rolling Stone rather, about all of the 400 journalists that were working for the CIA. So there's always been some level of control, right? Going back to Bill Paley and Time Magazine. But I think things got really funneled in that late 70s period. But then there's more rabbit holes you can go down. Go research Katharine Graham, whose family owned the Washington Post, and what happened to her husband. And what, you know, there's all kinds of rabbit holes on all this stuff. But I think that's when things started to really get crap. And then, of course, you got Ronald Reagan as president, who is, quote unquote, the great communicator. And it's morning in America, and we're going to forget all this bad stuff, and we're just going to be super positive, and we're going to go back to doing what we do best. Invading small countries that can't defend themselves against us. And that's what we did.
Your dad's book at a conference, does he share the same political kind of deep politics, deep dives? Like, is he aware of a lot of the work that you've done and kind of agree with somewhat of it? Or does he have his own interest in history, maybe an earlier time period that's kind of shown him examples of how the government institutions actually run?
Yeah, not really. Especially at first. Because I was a teenager and I was suddenly talking like, H-Rap Brown or something, which is true. Kind of a rabble, counterculture rabble rouser. But no, not really. I mean, he understands. I mean, he reads my stuff. But I don't think he would go all the way with it.
What do you speak about at the conference?
A very specific part of history of this area, which is Laredo. He's writing a book on
Okay. At that, can I have him on when he's done with it? Do you not
it.
want
I
him to
can
talk to
ask
me? That's
him.
fine.
No, I just don't think he will do it, but
Sit him in
I'll tell
front of
him.
the camera and say, I'll hit record. We'll just go. Now, I wanted to ask, what president to you throughout history has shown you probably a deeper insight into how the government institutions actually run? I think I've mentioned this with when we did the chat with Rich, which we're gonna start doing this once a month. We got a plan one coming up. Truman is for me, just someone that I think has alluded to probably more than, and I would say Nixon. I know a lot of people don't like him. I mean, if you can get over the fact that he drops like these weird sexual speeches all the time, where I was like, why don't you just talk normal? Like, he's just always like thrusting and outrage and tension and pressure and hormones. And I'm like, why is he giving a speech about the economy talking about hormones? I don't get it. But that was Richard Nixon. But there's a lot of insight into these figures. And Truman has really kind of set the example for me, especially when it comes to a death that is still getting debated about today by the government and its investigations, which is the death of Dag Hammarskjöld, who the UN has not made an official conclusion on what exactly happened to Hammarskjöld.
Yeah. Well, you can, I mean, there's a who was that guy?
Bud Dwyer.
I can't think of his name. There was a researcher who was an airplane pilot who wrote a lot about plane crashes. And well, Sherman Skolnick for one. Sherman Skolnick was not involved in aviation, but he wrote a lot about aviation disasters. And if you wanted to just study plane crashes, that's a good field of study. I know that sounds crazy, but people of political importance either disappear or are in a plane that
Hail
goes down.
Boggs.
Yeah, Hale Broggs, Ron Brown. I mean, there's a million. And if you just did that, I think your eyes would be open and go, holy crap. Just listing them. And that's like one of the things I did in one of my books. I can't remember which one now. I just listed the number of assassination attempts on US presidents. And then I note which ones were successful and which ones weren't. And when you look at it, it's like, what the hell kind of country we got here? I mean, it looks like what most people associate with Latin America. That's what it looks like because there's so many presidents are shot at. I mean, it's a pretty dangerous job. And about every 20 years or so, we lose one in office, which is a little bit strange for what the United States of America is supposed to be, that we're continually having these, murders or questionable deaths while people are in office. And that, you go to congressmen and senators and you're going to find more of that stuff, unfortunately.
Which president?
I mean, the most important one to study, in my opinion, is Richard Nixon. Because so much material has been made available to the public. And I've said this so many times that just get the transcripts of the tapes, of the Nixon tapes, and you will learn a lot about government. Like if I was teaching a government course, that's probably what I would teach. It's like, this is going to be our text. Because it shows you a lot of how the sausage gets made. And what are they thinking about when they're making certain decisions? Like, how do you make a political decision? And these guys, Haldeman and Eric Ehrlichman and John Dean are in the room and they're talking about who they're going to get to do what and why. Yeah, let's give that to George Bush. He'll do anything we tell him. Yeah. Stuff like that is in the tapes where they're talking about, you know, we need, and same thing with like Jerry Ford. Like they think he's an idiot, but they think he'll do what he's told. And that's like a big thing. It's a big deal. Truman is interesting because Truman was not considered to be up for the job, that people were worried that Truman, like people in the government were concerned that Truman was kind of a lightweight, and then he turned out not to be. He's definitely interesting, but I would say Nixon is the most important one as far as if you're going to do this, that's who I would study first. You know, and even the way Nixon got into politics at all, he answered an ad from something calling themselves the Committee of 100. Like what? So the Committee of 100 put an ad in the newspaper looking for like a young man. I don't know if they said preferably with a naval background, but military background, you know, and Nixon answered that ad. They liked him and he was entered into politics. And that literally is how it happened. So that story in itself is crazy and should tell you a lot.
Do you believe that the Watergate burglary was just a couple of goofballs that got caught? Or do you think that was intended to bring down Richard Nixon? I tend to be in that group that, I mean, these guys were ex-CIA people, and you're telling me they just taped a door shut, and then when they saw the tape was pulled off, they bothered
the second piece of tape.
Yeah, that doesn't that doesn't jive with me. I mean, Cord Meyer, I think it was Meyer that was James McCord that was a part of the
James McCord,
The CIA guy. I mean, everyone in that group really had a CIA background and had some connection to the intelligence agency. Mm-hmm. Where I was like, how do you guys be a part of operations in the Central Intelligence Agency? Maybe our agency isn't that good. Maybe they are incompetent. I don't know.
I mean, maybe. And
tape, Joe, but, tape, but man. No, come on, a janitor, a janitor.
Yep.
He's probably making a minimum wage, which at the time was like, what, $5 maybe at the most. And he caught that. Come on.
And that second piece of tape tells you that it's a live function, right? Somebody replaced the tape. So therefore, this is happening
now.
Goddamn
Paul Blart coming in there and catching the water chamber.
Yeah. No, I do. I mean, I think it's telling. I mean, I've said this before, you know, it's E. Howard Hunt and his crew from the Bay of Pigs, which again, that should tell you something too. But no, I think that's basically right. That Nixon was so concerned about something. Right, the mysterious Bay of Pigs thing. I mean, which different people have different ideas of what that is. That he had started to basically try and create, he was trying to build a wall between himself and the actual CIA and FBI. He wanted his own CIA because he was so concerned. So, and it's this weird thing because he's been an ally with Hoover, but he also has this uneasy relationship with Hoover. They both know the same criminals, right? They both were supported by some of the same people. So they have stuff on each other. So it's this weird, like, they agree on most things, but they're also rivals in power. And Hoover doesn't see himself as, he thinks he's more important than the president, because no matter who the president is, he remains the FBI director, which is kind of what Helms, the who was then the CIA director, kind of what Helms says also. And of course, Helms had been involved in MKUltra, speaking of which, and all this other stuff. So, I always go back to Nixon. And I think you're right about Watergate. There was also a lot of other things that are connected to Watergate, like a prostitution ring, for example.
Wait,
and
what?
The security... A prostitution ring. That's a very long story.
I don't give a shit. Tell it, please.
No, I can't get into it because I don't know it that well, because there's a guy, the guy
you
who
just
wrote
wasted
for...
an hour. I could have been learning about the prostitution ring.
No, there was. And there's a good book by that Feral House put out by a real slime bag. And this guy, I guess I shouldn't say that's possibly libelous. But this guy who wrote this book about the prostitution call girl ring that was going on at that same time, because there has to be, you know, like
Nixon couldn't have been involved in that. There's no way.
Well, not Nixon himself, but people that are in the White House. So like, was it Heidi Fleiss? Was that her name? The DC madam that hanged herself. But that was about, 10 or 15 years ago now.
If you're asking me how many white girls have hung themselves through history, you're going to be here for a long time.
Yeah, dude. No, I think it was Heidi Fleiss. I may have that wrong. But there are professionals, right, for everything. So if you're going to, if you are, how do I want to put this? You're a powerful person and you want to get laid. That can be done clandestinely. And that will be done with professionals.
That's why there was that red button in the White House that he pressed. You saw Biden press it and he got ice cream that came to
him. Oh, yeah, right.
It
yeah.
used to be for the call girls.
You can use it for anything, yeah. But no, that was a thing that happened. There's also the Securities and Exchange Commission. Because, again, as John pointed out, the SEC was on the floor above where the Watergate people were putting their bugs in, which means you would have been able to get stock tips like 30 minutes or so before they were announced. You know, this is like pre-internet, pre-everything. So if you were listening, you might get a tip on a big gain or loss about half an hour before anybody else, which means you could make a lot of money doing that.
I mean, what do you think the theory was for breaking into Watergate, if I ask your personal, because there's been a lot, and I didn't think this was controversial. At least I thought we had an answer. But apparently there hasn't really been a full definitive conclusion of why the Watergate burglary ever happened. I've swayed more towards the Howard Hughes stuff. There was two campaigns that were donated, or Howard Hughes had donated. One was with Humphrey and Nixon, which is where we get Nixon Burger, which is the donation to the Donald Nixon, his brother, burger chain restaurant. And then there was another one that was donated directly to Bebe Rebozo, who was a person that was connected with Richard Nixon. And I mean, if you look at Nixon before he resigns, he makes a statement about the loan. He talks about that he was a president that didn't have any money or backers, and he was trying to do this out of his own, which, I mean, if you believe it or not, but it's just him saying that and acknowledging that and him thinking that was what really took him down makes me kind of sway towards he was looking to get rid of that information or any information on the Howard Hughes loan, because obviously people knew about it. At Donald Nixon's opening to his restaurant, they had a banner, and Nixon's in front of it standing there with like his thumbs up and like a really cool, like, but the banner's in a different language. And it says, ask him about the loan on the banner. And then they open up fortune cookies, and inside the fortune cookies, you know, they're all laughing at communism. Ha, look how funny it is to have fortune cookies. And it says, ask him about the loan. So someone was aware of it, and someone was trying to bring out that greed aspect, but I think that's what sunk him. I mean, what do you think was the purpose of the Watergate burglary in your perspective?
I mean, I do think that ultimately it was to bring down Nixon, because Nixon was becoming a real problem. And not necessarily so what I was talking about before, what Nixon was trying to do, but it's also true that Nixon was drinking a lot. And he would wander like the halls of the White House drunk, you know, talking to the paintings. So they may have also been concerned that he was not stable anymore.
God, I used to think all the time in my head, like, if I could be in one place in time, where would it be? Where I could just be like, just be standing there like a ghost. And not, I was always saying the sixth floor at the exact time that the shooting happened to see if there was actually anybody up there. But now I would take it back and be in the halls when Nixon's walking around drunk. I would love to hear what he's saying in his paintings.
Yeah. There's a
passionate,
great,
astute. I'm like, you psycho. You fucking psycho.
Look up a film called Secret Honor. It's actually by Donald Freed, who was the guy who said all those things about Jonestown. But Donald Freed is a really good writer. And it was a play. It's a one-man play. And it's Richard Nixon alone in his office after he's been removed from office. And the sort of the premise of the play is that every night, Richard Nixon sort of gets drunk and talks to a tape and makes up new excuses as to what happened. But Freed had done a lot of research, and a lot of the things that Nixon says in the movie are absolutely correct. Like, he gets a lot of that stuff right. And I always, you know, if you have any interest at all, watch that. And it's kind of like being a ghost in the room with Richard Nixon, because he's the only guy and he's talking all this stuff, and he talks about the Committee 100. He talks about the Bohemian Grove and all the stuff he doesn't like about DC political life. You know, it's fascinating. In one of my own plays, these guys build a time machine, and one of them says, wow, we can use our time machine to go to the sixth floor and stop the Kennedy assassination. And the other guy says, how would that stop the Kennedy assassination? Because there's nobody shooting from the sixth floor. So obviously that's not where you're going to, if you're going to use your time machine, it's not going to be to go there. That would be the last place you'd go. But yeah, no, I kind of agree. I would love to be there. I'm totally fascinated with Richard Nixon. I mean, he's a fascinating character. And he was also a mess. Like, he was a very intelligent guy who was not very wise, who made some really bad decisions and got himself into real trouble. And he was also, like, his actions with Kissinger and invading Cambodia, like, totally indefensible. That is psychotic. You know, they burned a lot of peasant farmers for no reason whatsoever. And there was never any real strategic reason to be in Vietnam anyway. I mean, that was just so that Raytheon could get paid, essentially, like these different companies who build this equipment to keep the war going. And, you know,
now, I'm
Bell helicopter.
I'm friends with academics who are very critical on the Nixon stuff. And it's usually when you pop up books about Nixon, it's either friends of Nixon's or people that were around when Nixon was, like, you know, his prime, either in his office, like Jeff Shepard I've had on. But then I have other people that are very critical of Nixon, and they talk about how there's this apologetic view of looking at Nixon, and like there's this kind of reversal of trying to bring out, like, oh, he wasn't as bad oaf like we all thought he was. But they're like, no, he was an oaf, and they just go really critical on him. And I go, yeah, but when your description of him doesn't fit what I can look up in video and see of Nixon talking. I mean, I'm not a conservative. I don't believe in any of those. I don't believe in a political party at all. But when I look at Nixon's older kind of speeches and things of that sort, did you freeze on my screen? Okay, just making sure. You were very still. I was like, good God, did I lose you?
I'm practicing.
Blink every once in a while. Damn. No, I just, but there's, I'm looking at his speeches, and he was talking about that we need to take care of the drug culture that's out there, and it is ruining the freedom of democracy, or just the idea of democracy and what this country stands for. It's corrupting all these kids' minds. And I go, I don't disagree. I've never wanted to ban it, but I've been very, very careful about having both sides of the legalization argument on my show because of the fact I am concerned about when we quickly go the 180 degree way that we've gone in the past, we tend to miss hurdles. And those hurdles could be safety of children. You know, they're able to get a cake pop on the street for 1500 milligrams when you could smoke 10 bowls back in the day and could not get that high. So there's starting to be a lot of research on paranoia and really large schizophrenia and psychotic symptoms that come with marijuana now because of the fact that it's been so upgraded with the newer technology and newer processes. So when I hear him say that, I go, I like what he's saying. But I just think that he wasn't very good at implementing a lot of the things that he talked about. And that's like with every president, there's been very good speeches and stuff of that sort. But I go, he definitely wasn't an oaf. He wasn't someone that was like, oh, call up with his pants down, dumb Richard Nixon, that history has kind of remembered him as. I go, he could have easily exposed so many political figures with everything that was going on, but he chose to stay silent because either he believed in the keeping the secrecy of the intelligence agencies or any of that. But he could have put everyone on blast and he didn't. And I go, we have to question why that didn't happen.
Mutually assured destruction.
Still, he was already going down.
Yeah, but that's not the only thing that can happen to him.
Yeah, but I feel like you could light up the intelligence agencies worse than that.
Nobody knows.
Hoover's an address, and then you just drop the mic and walk out.
Nobody knows more about what happens to presidents who get out of line than Richard Nixon, right? I mean, he knows, whether he was involved directly in the Kennedy assassination or not, which I don't think he was, but he knows, like, what happened.
I want to get a shirt that says that he knows.
So, yeah, no, I think it's the same principle that we applied to the Soviet Union. It's mutually assured destruction. And in fact, I think most politics works on the same principle, that the reason that more people don't step out of line is precisely because of that. They don't say, oh, that guy's a pedophile or that guy's this or that, because they are too. I mean, they know what crimes they've done. And that's what all the Yale stuff is about. The secret society stuff is you tell everybody your innermost secrets. And then you trust them for the rest of your life because they know your innermost secrets.
You can't say the word pedophile anymore. They changed it to character of sensitive proportion.
Yeah, I'm not saying that.
Okay. We're having too much fun with this podcast. On a wrapping point, now I appreciate your time, Joe. Seriously, you know I always love chatting with you, man. Like I said, we're gonna book a podcast with Rich.
Okay.
But on an ending point, trying to tell people what a takeaway to be with understanding or giving the open door to conspiracies, or just looking at what I would call, like, and this is a kind of a two-parter question, but alternative media, alternative history. What about looking into, for anyone that would want to look into alternative history, the importance of that and also the roadblocks for that? But then also, how do you feel as an alternative history person to be on platforms like my show that are just alternative media, which I wouldn't even really consider myself media, but we're not respectable in the sense of like an actual institution that could give you the time. And I wish I did have that, but I don't. So I would like to know your thoughts on that, because obviously there's some wacko shows out there. I mean, I can be considered a wacko show with talking about as much as I talk about Howard Hughes and ice cream. Good God, that man is fascinating. But obviously there's a two-parter in there, history alternatively, and then media alternatively.
Well, what I would say in general is when you think about like what is alternative history, most of the time, alternative history is just history, but it's unpopular with the state. And that's what you're really talking about. And I would point to the fact that many, many times in history, it has turned out that one government or another has suppressed information that they knew to be true because they did not want to rock the boat. They wanted to maintain their own power. So part of it is just not even thinking about it as alternative history or alternative media. I mean, I understand it is because it's marginalized, but most of the time we're just talking about actual history. And we do history the same way other historians do. Professional historians, they go and look for evidence. That's what we do. The difference, the thing that you're talking about is when things get wacky, is when people spout off things that they're just saying, you know, that like the right wing is obsessed with this thing about Barack Obama. I don't know why they're still obsessed with Barack Obama, like he's not in power anymore. But you know that he's gay, right? Like, who cares, first of all? And why are we talking about this? Like, okay, so what if he is gay? I mean, what possible difference could that make? But you can see the agendas in what's being pushed. And that's the thing. I think that's the dividing line. Like, do you have a specific agenda that you are married to and that you're trying to push, or are you just looking at the facts flat on as best you can? And I think that's the thing to pay attention to. I can tell when I'm reading something, and like it's Kennedy now, especially. I start reading a Kennedy book and they start saying all this stuff, and I go, okay, yeah, I know what this guy's doing. Like, this is a mob did it guy. Or, you know, the first page is about Marilyn Monroe. Okay. Yeah. So after a while, you can develop your own sniff test for looking at this stuff. But I would encourage people to do it. I mean, I do not believe in harmful information. I don't think that information by itself is inherently harmful. I also think there's another thing to point out here, which is that cooperation is a neutral value. That is to say, we want everybody to cooperate and get together and like, you know, we should all work together, which is great. But you also should know that, you know, cooperation is what enabled the Nazi Party. Right? Cooperation is what enabled Pol Pot and Joe Stalin to kill 9 million Ukrainians, right? Cooperation is neutral. It depends on what you're cooperating about. So I would also leave you with that thought, because just because somebody is telling you that we all need to cooperate doesn't mean that that's a good thing.
Joe, where can people find your links?
Joe Green, JFK, Hidden History Center. Joe Green JFK is the main one. You can get to that, and you get to, you know, say something real press and all that stuff. It's all basically on that one.
Okay. I'm going to make sure to link all that in the description. It's been a pleasure chatting with you again. And thanks everybody for listening to this episode of Out of the Blank. Stay tuned for our next episode.